too long ago, destroying the Cygnus spacecraft along with it. Wanted to mention that, and New Horizons as well, that will be in the news this year. New Horizons on the way to Pluto. We talked about how far, you asked me a couple of weeks ago, how far or how close will it get to Pluto? Low ID. Repeater, okay. How's my signal, Dick? WS2M.
You sound real good, Paul. Please proceed. And they're coming through Eastern Machine also. Not to worry.
USL. Talk about how close the New Horizon was going to get to Pluto. My guess was 6,000 miles from what I remember reading a long time ago. Researched out a little bit of it. That was off by 300 miles. 6,300 miles. But it will be passing that planet at a higher speed, 27,000 miles per hour will be the approaching speed. But it sounds like they don't have much time to do much science. But the science will really start about 2 months before and a couple of months after. They have 7 different instruments on board, you know, besides the Lori Optical Telescope. They've got other equipment, ultraviolet, infrared, plasma detectors. They'll be looking at the atmospheres of both Pluto and Charon. They'll be looking at a lot of, things like the kind of plasma is coming from the sun and atmosphere in it, but you know, naturally the high details with the optical telescope. A couple of months before and a couple of months after. Of course, the most interesting will be when they get very close. They don't have an actuating platform on board of New Horizons. The spacecraft is actually going to rotate. They have a little setup where it's going to rotate in a certain direction so they don't get any blurring of pictures. And work quite good with the
repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
Not to have a movable platform. And that's pretty much it, Dick. I know there's a couple of weeks in January with an Atlas V, and that will be putting one of three satellites in geosynchronous or geostationary orbit, actually, which help the military use their phones, their cell phones. The satellites will act as cell phone towers, and the accuracy, the sensitivity of these things is supposed to be quite good, even to the point that if you're near the North Pole, it will work. They've done some tests, so that's a military flight. And that's pretty much it, Dick. Any questions or anything? This is WS2N. And I could always be reached at spacenetreport@gmail.com. Back to you, Dick. Any questions?
Question for Paul?
You got it, Sean.
KC2WGP. Paul, length of day on Pluto, do you know it?
No, it's, but they're going to have time, view the whole planet. I don't know what its rotation is. With 4 months, they should be able to do it pretty good. But back to you, John.
Okay, good enough. Yeah, 4 months should give them a good shot at getting quite a bit of that coverage. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Yeah, New Horizons is going to approach Pluto as close as 6,300 miles. But moving 27,000 miles an hour at a time, there's a 4-to-1 ratio there. So you could say it's only going to be close to Pluto for a quarter of an hour, 4-to-1 ratio, 15 minutes. But during that 15 minutes of super closeness, boy, there's going to be a huge conflict of interest as to where do you aim the telescope, which satellite do you look at, What part of the surface of Pluto do you look at? What instrumentation do you turn on to measure cosmic rays, magnetic fields, and so on? That's a very busy, let's call it the 1 hour around closest approach is going to be extremely busy time. Let me drop.
The Earth, the time on that planet is 6.39. That's from Dave.
Are you saying 6.39 days is one revolution of Pluto? Is that what you're saying, John?
Affirmative, Dick.
Okay, that's a pretty long day. Getting back to James Webb, it's going to go to the Lagrange number 2 point, which is close to 1 million miles away from the Earth, on the back side of the Earth compared to the Sun. And that's a very desirable place to be, where you don't get a lot of radiation from the Earth, or the radiation from the Sun. You put a five-layer sun shield between you and the Sun. However, because you're behind the Earth, you're being shadowed by the Earth. Doesn't that mean for a certain number of hours per month, the solar arrays on New Horizons is going to be in the Earth's shadow, not seeing the sunlight directly? WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, the Earth will probably most of the time not even be shadowing the spacecraft. It's in what they call a halo orbit, and they do that to pretty much stabilize it the best they can. If they were to keep it directly behind the Earth, they say you'd have to use a lot of fuel to balance it at that point. So they can put it into a halo, and it's, you know, we're looking at 500,000, you know, it's a 500,000-mile diameter halo orbit. Most of the time, the sun will be actually coming and hitting the spacecraft. And that's why they have the big sun shade. You know, the Earth isn't serving that purpose at all. So, that's what I've read about that. With, five layers of a sunshade enough to shadow it, and then with the cryogenics on board, that will finish the job from what I've read there.
Okay, so this great big halo orbit means that it doesn't dwell directly behind the Earth. It's in this quasi-circular orbit that's in a plane parallel to, perpendicular to the Sun. So I guess if you were on New Horizons, correction, if you're on James Webb and you look toward the Sun, I guess it'll look like you're always going around the perimeter of the Earth, but with a big enough circle that you always see the Sun out from behind the Earth, so to speak. So, if I understand you correctly, the solar cells are going to see essentially continuous sunlight, and if the halo is big enough and properly positioned, you never go into the shadow behind the Earth. Is that true, Paul? K2RIW?
Yeah, that's true. That's what I've read. And don't forget, this thing is not RTG, so they do have solar cells to power this thing. And so, you know, you do need sunlight. And they've got let's call it a ion deflector on the back of the spacecraft too, which could be actuated, and as the solar wind comes out, pushes on the spacecraft. You'll keep the telescope more stable if you have this wing-like device that's part of this whole complicated thing that's going to unfurl. Get that antenna, the secondary antenna. You have to watch the secondary mirror to see how that thing comes out. It's an incredible maneuver. This linkage that it's hooked up to. You've got 1 million moving parts on this thing. You don't have 1 million, but it seems like that. But it should be very interesting to see them successfully do everything that they're supposed to do. I hope they do it for Dallas, but I thought that when Curiosity landed on Mars with that complicated sky crane system, I thought that was a complicated system. This is, that's nothing compared to what this thing's going to do. Back to you, Dick.
Do we know, I'm guessing that liquid helium is the cryogenic material that's going to be cooling the main detector. Do we know roughly what temperature in degrees Kelvin the detector will be running? How long will that cryogenic material last? And what happens to the sensitivity when the cryogenic material is consumed? I wonder if we have any of those numbers, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
7-year primary mission, so I guess they have enough of that. And like I said before, they can use the telescope in the optical range, so even if they run out of cryogenics, it will still be functional. One thing they won't have to worry about is bringing it back to Earth, like the Hubble. Where's it going to land? They don't have that problem. By the way, anybody interested in the Falcon 9 flight that SpaceX was going to launch to the International Space Station using the Dragon cargo vehicle, that was delayed. I mentioned that in the last couple of weeks. In fact, that's been delayed on and off for a month or two. And that will be going up on January 6th. That's the new launch time for the Falcon 9. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I think January 6th is a Tuesday, 1 week from 2 days from now, so to speak. Now, you described some wing-like devices out at the perimeter of James Webb, where the solar wind is going to be hitting them, and by changing their orientation, you change the amount of torque it creates. And if I understand correctly, this passively does positioning, aiming of the James Webb. Sounds a little bit similar like what they're trying to do with the Kepler telescope. I'm a little bit amazed that we've always used reaction control gases, which are a consumable, in order to do positioning. And I'm wondering why we haven't used solar wind panels, tunable solar wind panels, in the past to passively orient our spacecraft. So did I understand you correctly that there are these tunable panels at the perimeter of James Webb that as you aim them, the solar wind hitting them allows you to steer the thing in azimuth and elevation, so to speak. WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, it looks like just one panel. It's probably, I don't know, in relationship to the size of the thing. I haven't seen the numbers, but I mean, it looks like 10 by 10 sticking out of the back of James Webb. They have, to some degree, I know a mission going around Mercury Messenger, that they have big solar panels are built in such a way that they're also using them as to help keep Messenger oriented as it goes around Mercury. I don't know if it's been... It definitely hasn't been a main system. You know, they always use the moment wheels that they spin up, slow down. Of course, the number one way of doing it is more of a nitrogen thrusters. I'm sure James Webb will have all of that. But naturally, to cut back on fuel, you're gonna have this. I'm trying to think what it's called, but it's a deflecting control mechanism using the solar wind. I want to mention the Kepler. Yeah, the first planet discovered by the extended mission, I guess you would call it. They're calling it a Kepler 2. Using the same system that we're talking about, the wind is acting on the panels, the solar panels, to control the attitude of Kepler. It's already come back now with its first discovery of another planet going around another star system. But, you know, in the Kepler 2 or K2 time frame. Back to you, Dick. WS2S.
Paul, is K2 back into full operation? And how long ago did it go back into essentially full operation and proper orientation? Over to you, Paul.
I thought it's been a couple of months, and that naturally takes some time to get the results. When they download the information, they have to research everything. But I know that just came out last week, the information on that planet. I think it's like 8 times the size of Earth, but it's the first one that, you know, first one for the second time around for Kepler.
What I think Kepler does is it waits until a planet sweeps in front of its local sun, and that creates a slight dimming of the light, and you want that planet to go around twice. You want to see a pair of dimmings, and maybe even three, so you can get proper timing. So if Kepler has only been in operation a couple of months, and it has discovered a new candidate planet, that suggests that that planet is pretty close to its sun in order to pass in front of its sun twice in the couple of months that K2 has been operating. Is that approximately true, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
I would say so. I don't know. I'm glad to see it's got an extended mission like that. Remember, not too long ago, they were talking about that was the end of Kepler, and here it is on an extended mission there. It's just going to be a little different, you know. Kepler was staring at one spot the whole time. Now it's going to be going around on the, you know, following the Earth around the sun and looking out. And, you know, I guess it's only going to be looking out toward the ecliptic, but it's not going to be looking in one place. They're trying to look at suns that are closer, you know, to Earth. Whatever it is, they figured out that this is going to be the best use of Kepler. I mean, it's there. Don't throw it away now. It's functional. It's already now discovered another planet. They'll probably do a lot more. After picking out all these planets, they'll have a good idea which ones they really want to look at with the James Webb Space Telescope, too. Keep that in mind. James Webb is not only going to be used for looking at the beginning of time, you know, the first stars ever, first galaxies ever, but they can use it for investigating a planet, maybe detecting the chemicals coming off of it, methane and things like that. Back to you.
Because James Webb has a mirror that's so much bigger than Hubble. I don't know the exact number, but if you told me it had 10 times the area, I'd believe it. And it's looking pretty far into the infrared. You put the combination of a super-sensitive, cryogenically cooled detector, looking into a frequency range that's never been seen before, doing it with a mirror that's about 10 times bigger, and if they do an ultra-deep field measurement with James Webb, can you imagine what they're going to see with that, Paul? Wow. But now, here's my question. You got the main frame of James Webb. Let me drop. You got the main frame that's got a 5-layer sun shield on the side of the frame that goes toward the sun. Beyond that, you've got the solar panels. On the non-solar side, you've got the great big mirror and the focal point. I am guessing that mirror and focal point is on a azimuth bearing, which can be aimed at various azimuths, always at right angles to the direction toward the sun. That's the azimuth bearing. If you want to look at a different elevation, I'm not familiar that James Webb has an elevation bearing. But since it's at L2, and once every year, it sweeps 360 degrees around the ecliptic. I guess you could say you wait until the right time of year for it to be at the right elevation. At that time, you steer it with the azimuth bearing in order to look at a particular direction. So I'm a little curious as to how you keep James Webb staring in one particular direction for, let's say, a few days, like you did with, I think it was a million seconds for the ultra deep field pictures with Hubble. I'll have to figure out how many days that is, but it sounds like about 10 days. How do you keep James Webb with one constant orientation for 10 days? WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, I haven't looked at the science part of the mission that much, Dick. I just assumed it had an ASO system on the mirror. I can't imagine, you know, every time they need to, let's look up a little, down a little, changing the whole spacecraft. For that matter, they've got to be able to rotate that left, right, up, down. I'll look into it, but I just can't imagine it. I don't know. It would be interesting if they do have it. How far can they go? You know, can they go right angle to where they are? And right now, you see the you look at the picture of James Webb. It looks like a 90 degree coming off the, you know, in relationship to the platform, the sunshade. We'll have to see. Oh, by the way, I want to acknowledge Don. AB2IF sent me an email, and we'll talk about that maybe next week or something on locating the ISS. Very good. Thank you, Don. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
Tell us what Don said. Give us a few words on that one. Paul, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, I'd have to look into what he sent me here. It'd take me a minute. He's got a nice website on locating the International Space Station. A whole article on how to locate it. Couple of pages, take me a while to read it, but it looks good. I've tried the Heavens Above before, a little complicated type of thing, but one might be better. I'll have to look into it. And the other system, now you go onto the NASA site. If you have the app, you can get the NASA app. If you have a mobile tablet or a phone, click on that. They'll tell you when the next pass for wherever you live might be. You know, if you have a GPS in your system, like one tablet I have doesn't have a GPS in it, so that's no good. But the other ones do. And they'll let you know when the ISS is going overhead. Back to you, Dick. This is WS2N.
Paul, did I earlier hear you say that James Webb is $8 billion? B for boy, $1 billion. Did I hear you say that? Because I think Hubble was around $2 billion. I think each space shuttle was around $2 billion. If James Webb is $8 billion, that's a fairly hefty price tag. But it's an awful big piece of hardware. When you see that model of it that they built out in front of the facility in Maryland, you see a whole bunch of people standing around it. My goodness, is that a big piece of hardware? It looks more than 10 times bigger than Hubble. $8 billion. I'll bet you when it was first proposed, they didn't think it was going to be quite that expensive. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, that's how come they kept canceling it. It was supposed to be $500 million, $500 million back in 1993. When they dropped this thing up, you know, Hubble went up in 1990, right away, okay, we need to have a replacement for Hubble. You know, it's got to have, Hubble's not going to last forever. So they came up with this, and they called it the New Generation Telescope. That was, you know, they had to call it something. So, and then the years went by in 2003 or something. I'm not sure the exact year they decided to give it a name, James Webb, you know, for the second administrator of NASA. Really pushed and pushed and was quite instrumental in making sure that funding got passed for the Apollo mission. So now he's got his name attached to this thing. But yeah, I heard $8 billion. So now that's, they really started funding this thing probably 20 years ago. But like I said, they canceled another quite a few times. They put a hold on it and they brought it back. If you think about that, I think it's $2.5 billion to build the Tappan Zee Bridge. This thing's supposed to be $8 billion. But you gotta think of some other things when it comes to money. Let me drop it. Total amount of money that the government takes in taxes, I read somewhere, is $4 trillion. I don't know if that's true, but $4 trillion. Out of that money, they're paying off the national debt. They're paying military, of course. Defense is a tremendous percentage. And a fraction of that, or a small fraction of that, of what goes to military is the NASA $18 billion per year. That's usually about the number that they get funding, $18 billion. With the $18 billion, they've got to support existing missions. Somebody's got to be paid to, you know, to send signals to the Voyager and Opportunity on Mars, Cassini. You know, you got to, a lot of support on existing missions, never mind the other ones that are being built, like James Webb and what's the next one, the 2020 rover coming up, and that's going to go to Mars, very similar to Curiosity. $18 billion a year. Remember, $8 billion for, let's call it 20 years, you know, probably a little less than 20 years, but you know, spread that over time. That out of that money, say maybe $1.5 billion or something is going to be left over for operations after. You know, so maybe it's really, you know, 5.6 or, you know, 5.5 or 6 billion to get it where it's going to be at L2, and maybe another $2 billion of operations over next 7 to 10 years, I guess. Back to you, Dick.
I'm in, Dick.
Yeah, I just did some, John Rickey, I did some quick calculations here, John. If you said that the taxation in the United States is taking in $4 trillion per year, and if I assume that the population is 330 million people, that's $12,000 per man, woman, and child. In other words, are we being taxed as the average human being in the United States being charged, taxed at the rate of $12,000. If so, then the government is taking in $4 trillion. James Webb had $8 billion spent over 330 million citizens, is $24 per citizen, man, woman, and child. So $24 per citizen buys you James Webb, and if that's being spread over 20 years, that's $1.20. per year. So each of us is spending $1.20 per year to fund the James Webb. I'm convinced we're really getting our money's worth on that one. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Europe is paying for part of that. We're not even paying for the launch stick.
So therefore, we're not even paying $1.20. We're getting it probably for less than $1. That's too cheap. I think you ought to add some more doodads and bring it up to $10 billion. We can afford it. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick. Jeff, A1KBY would like to try to get in So just give him a break. He's in Connecticut. Let's see if he can make the 8-5 machine. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, we're going to stand by. K1 KBY, you have the floor, sir. Go ahead, Jeff. K2 RIW.
Hey, folks. Good evening. Good evening to the net. It's actually N1 KBY, and I'm up in Simsbury, Connecticut. So we'll see if you can copy me.
Yes, I'm copying you quite well on the input. The machine is getting you kind of noisy, but we're hearing you. So fire away with your question if you happen to have one, Jeff. Go ahead.
I'm copying the machine, and we'll come back to a question at some point in the future. So.
N1KBY, you did fade out in the machine. You were quite noisy in the machine. At my house, you are dead full quieting. I'm getting an S4 signal from you. So, I guess, and I'm only 20 miles from the machine. Huh. Maybe there's a little bit of a mountain or a building or whatever between you and the machine. Or, Jeff, are you using an aimable antenna? Maybe you're aimed more at me to the south, and you got a little bit more to the west to get to the machine. Are you using an aimable antenna, Jeff? N1KBY, K2RIW.
W-H-Y-Y. He might be better off trying to go into Selden than Glen Oaks.
Yeah, let me try this. 147375. Let's see if we have a better path on this one. From Simsbury, Connecticut, Hartford area. Over.
Yeah, when I listen to the 375 machine, you're close to dead full quieting into that machine. However, they are doing a repair job on the link between that machine and the main machine, and therefore you sound a little bit noisy. But that is a better path. So that is, for right now, the best way that you're getting in. 375 does get you in better, more reliably, as long as that machine's on the air. Occasionally it goes off. Is your antenna aimable, or is it a ground plane-like antenna, Jeff? N1KBY, K2RIW.
The antenna I'm on right now is the highest one up for VHF use, and that is not aimable. It is a omni. Over.
Okay. Of all the 2-meter antennas you own, is any of them, even if it's horizontally polarized, don't worry, is it aimable?
Yeah, but I can't use it at the moment.
Okay. Yeah, I've been pleasantly surprised on a couple of occasions when I take an aimable antenna, horizontally polarized, and aim it properly at a repeater. Sometimes you're not aiming it at foresight. You may be aiming 20 degrees off foresight where it gives you the stronger signal. That's the so-called Condon lobe effect. In other words, the cross-polarized lobes on some antennas fall in some funny places. That's not the normal foresight. So when you get a chance someday to test with your aimable antenna, you might be pleasantly surprised. So, I presume you've been listening to the TechNet for a while, and from time to time you wish you could get in with a question. Is that roughly true, Jeff? Back to you, Jeff.
Yeah, occasionally there's some topics that certainly pique my interest, and I'd love for you to make a comment or ask a question. So good to know that I can make it. Thanks for the check, and I'm sure you'll be hearing from me at some point in the future.
Yeah, when I get a chance, I'm going to look up your Latin long and find out how many miles there is between you and me and you and the repeater. I'm hearing you beautifully on the input, on either frequency. Okay. Anyone else with any further questions for Paul on the space section, or John on the mailbag section, or me on the ordinary section? Anybody with any questions, give us a call. That is right now, K2RIW.
I tried to get Jeff. I turned my antenna. I didn't hear him. I didn't get a chance to look up his QTH. I don't know if he was in Easton or Weston, Connecticut. Dick, for your curiosity, you had three stations from Canada on IRLP listening, and one from Jersey, and right now you got one from Canada, one from Jersey, so tune in on Reflector 9126.
Very good. Thank you, Joe. So, I wonder if even the Canadian guys have got a question. Does anybody have a question? We're going to stand by and see if anybody signs in. Give me a call, letters and name right now. K2 KC2RIW in the check net.
KC2SHO, John.
Hello, Charlie 2, Sierra Hotel, Oscar. Go right ahead, John. You're allowed to make question, comment, whatever. You can even say insults if you want to. Go ahead, John.
Thank you, Dick. Earlier this evening, you mentioned during the discussion about the passive repeating option and the antennas involved with that, you had mentioned a website where you can get some of these custom printed circuit board antennas, but it went by quick and I did not have a pen in hand. Would you mind repeating that information, please?
Yeah, very fine, John. Yeah, my favorite printed circuit antenna guy, Kent Britton is his name, by the way, also has a British ham radio license, is Whiskey Alpha 5 Victor Juliet Bravo, WA5EJB.com. Whiskey Alpha 5 Victor Juliet Bravo. You go to that website and you'll see he's got a zillion different kinds of green printed circuit, EHF, UHF antennas, log periodics, Yagis, whatever, dipoles, patch antennas. A little bit difficult to find it, but there's a second or third page on his website where he shows you how to make very cheap Yagis out of coat hanger wire and wooden slats. And the most expensive part of the antenna is going to be the input connector. So he can give you lots of gain for very few dollars on any frequency you care about when you find that second or third page of his website. So there's some pretty good information there. Some of his antennas are log periodics, which cover some very wide frequency regions. Let's see if you need a repeat on that, John. KC2SHO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I believe I got that as a WA5, Victor, Juliet, Victor, and K2RIW, KC2SHO. Thank you.
It's a good thing you repeated it to me. You got it wrong. Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor, Juliet, Bravo. Whiskey Alpha 5, Victor, Juliet, Bravo. Kent, Britain. In something Plains, Texas. He's just outside of Dallas, Fort Worth. All of a sudden, I can't think of the name of the name of the town he lives in. But he's been making those printed circuit antennas for around 10 years. Let's see if you got the call letters right this time. John, go ahead.
Yeah, it is late. It's been a long day. Sorry for that. Yeah, WA5, Victor, Juliet, Bravo. I think we got it correct now. And I do want to say also that I have experimented a little bit with passive repeating, and we did this with DVB in the UHF TV band. Not a lot of results, I think one of the gentlemen said. Usually have to be in very, very close proximity to the antenna. Could be very useful if you got a cell phone that sits in one particular spot in the basement or something like that. But we were never able to get the energy needed to, say, you know, cover an entire room or a small area. Go ahead.
You mentioned something called DVB, Delta Victor Bravo. I'm not quite sure what that meant. If you were in a home where you get spotty cell phone coverage, you know, you stand in some rooms and you get only one bar, in other rooms you get nothing, and if on the roof you had a properly tuned antenna on the right frequency, a simple ground plane antenna, or if you're really going to go for the Cadillac approach, a Yagi antenna for the right frequency region of your cell phone operation aimed at the cell site, and then a coax cable, RG6, RG58, whatever, coming down into the house, and then a simple ground plane-like antenna in the house. You'd have to hold the cell phone close to the ground plane in the house, because as you get away from that antenna in the house, you're following the inverse square law. Let me drop it. Every time you double the distance between your cell phone and that ground plane antenna inside the house, the signal will drop off by 6 dB. It's hard to believe that after the signal has gone 4 miles from the cell site to the antenna on your roof, good common sense which leads you to believe that you're piping the signal into the house and that after that 4 miles or 4.1 miles wouldn't matter. It does. Because your antenna on the roof is picking up the signal, converting it to electrical signal that goes into the antenna in the house, the ground plane antenna, in my example. Now that ground plane antenna is a micro-micro-watt transmitter. And so your cell phone has got to be located close to it in order to get good coverage. But if you did it that way, you could triple the mileage between you and a cell site, in my opinion. I wonder if that makes some sense, John. KC2SHO, K2RIW.
Yeah, I'll give you something quick that's very good information, and it makes perfect sense. But the DVB would be a digital video broadcast, the European television standard. And worked for a company, doing some proprietary stuff on broadcast channels for sporting events. And they really were pushing to try and see if we could come up with some solutions to, cover small areas and little and rooms that were tucked away in some of these sporting venues, stadiums and racetracks and things like that, where they marketed their product and where we set up these terrestrial, portable terrestrial broadcast systems. But like I said, we experimented a bit, but never really, again, wasn't able to like cover entire rooms, and for exactly the reason you say. But they sent a lot of equipment down and said give it a try. So I learned a lot the hard way on that one. But it was worth the experience. You don't know until you try, right?
What was the frequency of the DVB? What kind of an antenna on the roof was receiving the signal? Was it then being amplified and then bred into the building on the same frequency or some other frequency? How far away was the transmitter? Was it a terrestrial transmitter, or were you listening to a satellite? Give me a couple of other specifics here, John. KC2SHO, K2RIW.
K2RIW, KC2SHO. We tried it in a bunch of different scenarios, usually with buildings and, outdoor stuff. We had portable masts with antennas on them. It's all UHF. UHF, U.S. television channels, but using the DVB standard on the 6 megahertz channel. Generally, these were between 50 and 200 watt transmitters, all on a very local, terrestrial-only scenario. No satellites, no anything like that. It was our system that we carried around or we installed in the building on an SFN configuration. So we could, and I was always using Yagis, we'd take on-channel cut antennas and point them directly at our, or as best as we could to get, near our transmitting antennas and bring it down into these rooms. Usually we weren't close enough to get very high powers into the antenna. We were trying to just say, poke an antenna out a wall, point it in the right direction, a short piece of coax, and point the other antenna into the room, hopefully trying to, fill the room with a little more RF.
So, if I understand correctly, then it's a low-power video transmitter, small number of miles away, antenna at your location picking up the signal, and so you thought you were going to irrigate a whole living room or whatever with this. In reality, when you connected the DVB receiver directly to the cable that went to the outside antenna, my guess is you were getting good reception, but until you added an amplifier, my guess is you weren't covering very much area inside the room. Is that true? K2RIW, you got it, John?
No, I'm sorry, I left out an important piece of the puzzle. Since we were talking about cell phones, in my mind, I had it all worked out, but I forgot to supply you with an important piece of the puzzle. These are handheld receivers, handheld DVB receivers that people carry around with them. We brought the system or installed the system locally. We're not talking miles. I'm talking on property. So if it was a football stadium, we covered the interior and exterior Stadium in the parking. It was a racing event. We covered the entire racing compound. But in many cases, we weren't getting into the recesses of these buildings, just like we're talking about here. So it's an almost identical scenario, just on UHF, typically in the upper UHF channels. We had some lower ones here and there, but always mostly in the upper, sometimes even in the 700 meg. We were leasing from other companies their space that they already had. But yeah, so wrap your mind around the cell phone thing. It's almost identical except DVB and television, so and the UHF band. So below the cell phone frequency, but the same identical scenario. Handheld units indoors in places where they just typically weren't working.
Was the television standard of the transmission the American 8VSB, or was it the European system? Over to you, John.
No, DVB, so that's the European standard, the COSDM.
Okay. If it was 8VSB, you know that multipath could kill you. Okay, we've got 45 seconds before we get cut off. This was TechNet number 1536. Of the series that began in September of 1982, 32 and a half years ago, 32 years and a couple of months ago. 73, you all, be kind to each other. John and I and Paul and Hal will be back next week and covering some more of this material. Over to you, John, KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Hey, Dick, by the way, that video I told you about, James Webb Space Telescope, 20, it's not 20 minutes, only 2 minutes, no more than 2 minutes. Happy New Year, guys. John, over to you.
Okay, Paul, very good. Happy New Year to everybody, and let's hope it's a better one. That would be nice. I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight, and look forward to doing the same thing again next week. Dick, have fun. KC2WGB.
Bye-bye, you all.
The time is 12:01 a.m., 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater.
W2CDL. I hear you, Andy. WS Twin.
doing as well. By the way, radio sounded great tonight. Wow. Yeah, audio, RF, everything seemed very good.
You can't listen to 900 anymore, can you?
No, I haven't returned that radio into service yet. I don't have a place for it. But I can probably arrange that for tomorrow. Anything you want me to look for?
No, I don't understand how you can't have a place for it. Well, if you do get an opportunity to listen, just listen to it.
Okay, will do. I'll set that up tomorrow. The thing is, the room, I have so many transceivers and receivers on the shelf, the 900 unit, I took that down to make a little room for another 2000X and never got to fit it back in.
Oh, well. That's the problem with having too much stuff.
DC2WGV. Yeah, that's part of the disease.
No, I've seen you a few ways. You have too much stuff.
Well, most of it works, believe it or not. Some of it's old, but it works well. It's always fun to play with.
Yeah, well, I bet if you put up a chart, I put each one of those pieces of text here and give it a run, and each time you use it, you put a little check mark. It'd be interesting to see how many check marks you have over 6 months or a year.
What's interesting is what you see on the QRZ page. Well, that's a couple of years old, that page now. There's a lot of new equipment, but that's only like maybe a quarter of what I have. If I go into the comics box in the other building, oh my God, there's tons of stuff in there.
Yeah, just remember, you can't take it with you.
Oh, yes, I can. That's part of my contract. Oh, it's absolutely going with me, because otherwise, they're going to put it all in the garbage.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure that it would fit in the box. Maybe if you had your own module here.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Another building. And I can put my dog in it, too. That works for me.
Well, I would have to have an antenna that's made out of marble.
Yeah, I'd also have to have electric. Oh, it's going to need a lot of stuff. The home away from home, far away.
Yeah, well, the electric lines and everything could be made out of marble, so that way in a couple thousand years it's still there.
Yeah, that's true. We had a very wealthy man here on Staten Island who was buried in one of those, and they wanted an electric light, and I run an electric service to a mausoleum. I don't know if you ever heard of that before.
No, actually, if you go to Europe, you'll see quite a lot of that. Don't ask me why, but it's just a place where the family goes and visits.
Well, I could see if it was the type that you could open up and go inside and sit down on the marble benches, you know, things like that. Yeah, I can see that, but, you know, this one's only maybe 12 feet by 12 feet. Can you put it in two people?
No, I mean, if you were Jesus Christ, I could see it, but otherwise it doesn't really make a lot of sense.
Well, that's America for you. But you say they do that in Europe. I didn't know that. I thought we were the only crazy people.
No, you know, you've got families of arms, they go back thousands of years and they have traditions.
But they didn't have electricity then. Alright. By the way, Dick was trying to get an explanation from you, but you had dropped out. He was interested in knowing what that C12 is on the new radios, or CF12, or is it CF4?
What are you talking about?
Matt bought a new radio, a 991, and it has a feature called CF4, I think it is. It has to do with something in the audio on FM.
Do you mean C4 FM?
Yes, I thought he said CF. Yes, C4 FM. That sounds like it.
Yeah, well, all the, you know, like Motorola and everybody else, the P25 radios are actually C4 FM. It's actually four symbols, 4K. If it's the actual JSON protocol, which is, you know, it's
next open source. They're probably the very next supplier of digital radio. What's the name of the company?
I think it is the Yaesu that he was speaking about. Well, I have to ask him. So C4FM. Yeah, that sounds like it. And what is the purpose?
Okay. They bought one of two Yaesu radios. They have a mobile radio with it. Handheld radio. They transmit normal FM, and they also transmit C4FM, which is a digital FM. And you can also hook a camera up to it, and you can do a lot of stuff with it. I have one.
Okay, so it's a digital mode. Now, does the radio, maybe some of them, switch automatically between the protocols if it recognizes the signal?
Right. Used in conjunction with a repeater. And if you want to listen to the repeater, I've got one on.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Note number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
I have it in the automatic one. Meaning if I start transmitting digital, the repeater will go to digital and won't hear a lot of white noise. But while I'm transmitting digital, somebody else can transmit analog, so you'll hear them in or buried in all that white noise. It's kind of weird.
Okay. All right. Well, I think, you know, we're headed to that, in that direction, and probably all digital within the next 8 years, 10 years, whatever. I don't think there'll be any more of this analog stuff. There's just no more room. Too many people want service.
No, I hope you're not talking about the amateur service, because analog ain't never going away from this.
Well, I look at it, it seems to be, they make the commercial stuff, and it slowly bleeds into the ham equipment because they're already manufacturing it. You know, a couple of diodes to jump stuff out, and we wind up with that equipment. It may have to go that way.
Don't mean you have to use it. And besides, all the manufacturers, including the commercial guys, their stuff is still capable of playing all by them. In case of emergency.
Well, that's a relief to hear, because I think we're going to get to that stage, because we're in that flux right now, and I'm not too sure they know exactly what they're doing.
Oh, if you weren't listening to the thing that earlier, I spell it out for you. The FCC says there's a lack of bandwidth. They're trying to get as much stuff as they can in as little space as possible. The manufacturer's saying, good, now we can sell our digital stuff.
Yeah. And they'll have that captured market. Yeah, I heard that, and I know the FCC wants to do it, but I don't know if we're there yet with the equipment to do it properly, because I hear some of the new equipment, and I've heard some digital radios, they do have, you were speaking about the difference in some of the audio quality. I don't know why it's causing that, but I notice a difference. I guess you can get used to it.
Well, the digital audio rots, okay? Why does it rot? Because it's compressed to hell. It uses a weird voice phonem oriented compression. And, the bit rates are really low.
Well, that's easy to fix. We'll broaden the bandwidth so we can put more information in there, and we'll be right back to where we started from.
Do you have an MP3 player, or you listen to MP3s?
Yes, I do.
Can you tell the difference between an MP3 player and a nice vinyl disc?
On symphony music that I know well, believe it or not, yes, I can.